Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
As I sat down to record this episode, I took a look at this grim Excel file I've got open on my laptop. It's sort of an open source data set that the ACLU has been compiling. A list of people who have died from COVID-19 inside our nation's jails and prisons. Right now, there are 241 entries, overwhelmingly inmates, but also staff. This is surely an undercount, and it will surely grow. So in this episode, we begin a partnership with the New Yorker Radio Hour, in which we're going to follow the developing crisis inside our prisons and jails. Will it change anything about mass incarceration? And if it doesn't, will that political reality undermine the larger public health effort to control this virus? The ACLU published a study that argues the national death toll from COVID-19 may increase by 100,000 souls because of the failure to get people out of jails quickly enough. People who are still our family members, our neighbors, our lovers. Their health ultimately impacts us all. I'm Kai Wright, and this is the United States of Anxiety, a show about the unfinished business of our history and its grip on our future. As part of our partnership with the New Yorker Radio Hour, I interviewed Udi Ofer at the ACLU. He's leading the organization's effort to get people out of these unsafe environments in jails and prisons. And he's been going county by county, state by state, asking elected officials to, one, stop arresting people, and two, to let the most vulnerable people out immediately. Our conversation is also part of this week's full episode of the New Yorker Radio Hour, and you can hear that over at their podcast. But here's what Udi told me.
We're getting pleas for help. I mean, we're getting videos, we're getting emails, we're getting phone calls from people inside prisons and jails and their family members. We got this one video of someone who is living inside of a prison that showed us the bar of soap that he is given that is supposed to last for 2 weeks. And it is the size of those, you know, complimentary soaps you'll get at a hotel, you know, that's supposed to last one night. Mm-hmm. We're in a real crisis situation in jails and prisons, and even more so than the crisis we're all facing across the nation. About 40% of people in prison before COVID-19 have at least one chronic health condition, such as asthma or diabetes, right? HIV is 4 to 5 times higher among people in prison than in the general population. People in our nation's prisons are older. So the communities that the CDC has told us are most vulnerable to COVID-19 are exactly the communities that are housed in our nation's jails and prisons.
So you guys have reached out to 25 states, right? 25
yes.
Governors, if I'm correct. What is it you were requesting, and who's sort of been taking the most effective action so far?
We're asking governors to tell their prosecutors, their police, their sheriffs, to stop bringing people into the system in the first place. Stop making custodial arrests for low-level offenses. If you have to make an arrest, give someone a ticket instead of taking them to central booking. That may sound like not a big deal, but right now it literally is a life and death situation.
And are there places that you see that are doing that, that are taking this up? Who's doing a good job?
Yeah. So look, I want to be careful here because I think everyone needs to do a lot more, but I also want to give credit where credit is due. So look, in Colorado, for example, Governor Polis has issued a couple of executive orders. We have seen about a 40% reduction in the state's jail population. And, you know, and sheriffs there and police officers are starting to, you know, get people, making sure the jail population is going down. In Wisconsin, we saw the secretary there begin releasing people on what's known as supervision holds. In Kentucky, we've seen a bipartisan coalition lead to an executive order that has led to about 800 fewer people in prison. And the county jails have been reduced by about 28%. Washington State Governor Inslee issued an executive order that got about 950 people out. New Jersey has been in the forefront in many ways, both through the Supreme Court and Governor Murphy issuing an executive order. So we are seeing examples we could point to. And I'm proud to say that some of these are even in Republican administrations, which I think is a very powerful statement. But we need
I was trying to track that math as you were speaking. I was trying to say, okay, which ones of these are Democrats or Republicans? So I would assume that it would be largely Democrats, but you are seeing Republicans who are stepping forward with this too.
Yeah, in Kentucky, the ACLU is working with Republican allies to get people out of prisons and jail. So look, I mean, the way I always talk about the movement to end mass incarceration is that in many ways, it's an island of political agreement in a sea of bickering, right? We've actually seen a lot of successes over the past couple of years in red states, in blue states, to begin tackling mass incarceration. But everything has become a lot more urgent now during this COVID-19 crisis.
I wonder how this changes that in the long term, you know, in terms of either making it more or less likely that movement will continue. I've thought about that. What do you think?
Yeah, look, I don't want to find a glitch. You know, I'm trying to be careful and not find anything positive about this horrible pandemic we're all living through, because there's nothing good about it. At the same time, you know, some mornings I wake up feeling a bit more hopeful where, look, we've always struggled to make the public and politicians realize that people who are living in jails and prisons are our families, are our neighbors, are human beings. And seeing the fact that more than 16,000 people had been released from prisons and jails by ACLU count since the pandemic began, and that the public is being supportive of this, gives me that ray of hope that maybe this is the tipping point that we've all been waiting for in the mass incarceration space.
And what about violent offenders? I mean, this is always the third rail of this conversation. I imagine those are the folks who are not being released at this time. What's going to happen there?
Yeah, it is true that in the vast majority of releases, it's mostly people who are held for drug or property offenses, or what are called nonviolent offenses. And that's unfortunate, particularly when you're talking about prisons, right? Look, one of the phenomenons of mass incarceration is that we have seen a 300% spike over the past 20 years of the number of people age 55 or older who are in prison. So the reason people are held for these long sentences a lot of times are because they were incarcerated for violent offenses that they engaged in when they were in their teens or in their 20s. Yet here we are 20, 30 years later, and they're still being incarcerated for these mistakes. So I'm hoping that in the coming weeks, we're going to see an increase of the number of elderly people who are being released, including people who were incarcerated for offenses involving violence. And to any listeners out there who are worried about what does that mean for crime in America, you know, the recidivism rate for elderly people is at the single digits, if not lower. People age out of crime. That is a fact that has been documented through many studies. It makes no public safety sense to hold someone when they're in their 50s, 60s or older, if the reason is public safety.
What about like correction staff and law enforcement unions? These are some of the folks who have traditionally been opposed to decarceration campaigns. And this outbreak is, I would imagine, not great news for prison guards either. You know, so how have they responded to this moment and this effort?
Yeah. So this is going to be a bit of a weird answer, but so far they haven't been vocal as they would otherwise about all of the releases that are happening. So in many ways, their non-response, I think, speaks volumes. Everyone's life is at risk. You know, there are more than 37,000 federal corrections employees, and I know that they're frustrated with the Trump administration's lack of an appropriate response. And I think we're going to start hearing more from federal correctional unions and from other spaces demanding more from the Trump administration.
I wonder if it will have any impact on how the decarceration movement operates out of this, if there's something new that will come out of it.
I can't answer that fully now, but one of the things that I'm noticing on my team, and this is, you know, it's a bit of an admission, right? We normally do not talk about the health of corrections officers. We're focused on people who are incarcerated in jails and prisons. We at the ACLU, we're about to release what we're calling a memorial for people who have died because of COVID-19 in prisons and jails. The first version of that was only going to include incarcerated people. But then as we were kind of talking about it, we were like, you know what? We have to include corrections officers. Hmm. You know, they're dying. They're risking their families. So we're going to add that. And I don't think we would have done that before COVID-19. So maybe we, even as the decarcerators, are developing more empathy for the people who not only live inside prisons and jails, but also work inside prisons and jails.
It's a note that maybe all of this will bring us together in one way or another, whether we like it or not.
I guess so, yeah.
Udi, thanks so much for talking with us about this.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for bringing attention to this important issue.
As part of our reporting partnership with the New Yorker Radio Hour, David Remnick, who hosts that program, spoke with a governor who has actually taken up the call to release people from prison. Up next, I'll share that conversation.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts. How are you holding up?
I'm holding up. I mean, we're going to, you know, today is going to be another day with several hundred more fatalities we're going to announce in a couple of hours. And we're in a meeting.
That's New Yorker editor David Remnick talking with Governor Phil Murphy of New Jersey. Over the past several weeks, Governor Murphy has begun releasing some people from state prisons as a precaution against the spread of COVID-19. They spoke as part of our ongoing reporting partnership with the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Governor, I know you've been inundated with information and so many challenges related to coronavirus for months now. But I have to ask, when did you first become aware that prisons were going to become a major hotspot for transmission and that the prison population was at particular risk?
Early on. I can't give you a specific date, but we knew that we're not going to crack the back of this virus if we only bring some of us along. We got to bring everybody along.
What is the prison population, and how many people are you planning to let out?
The population at the state level, I believe, is about 19,000, and that's down over time from 30,000 not that long ago. I don't have a county jail number specifically for you, but obviously there's a different jurisdiction there. And the number in terms of the folks who will be let out is yet to be determined. And so we're right now going through batches of populations, and the batches are defined by things like age, underlying conditions. Another one is within X days of maxing out a sentence. Another batch is folks within a certain amount of time to parole. Yet another batch is folks who had been up for parole within the past year and had been denied for whatever reason. So we're going through that process batch by batch. And as you can imagine, you want to get that right. Not just the right people are being released, but that there's something for them to be released to, just to make sure that folks have a place to go, a home, some sort of a safety net, that we're not just throwing people out in the streets And we got to be very careful in terms of those decisions.
How do you respond to the critics who have said that this process in New Jersey hasn't moved fast enough and that these people point to other states which have released many more inmates? How do you respond to that?
I've got to do this responsibly is my answer, and we take this very seriously. You know, we are, if you look at steps taken by states in America, and again, this is a general comment, but it does include corrections. I don't know that any state, when you add up all the steps we've taken in America, has been more aggressive. But we've also made sure that we've done it as right as we can. I'll give you an example. When we closed schools, we made each district come up with their emergency action plan. And unless we blessed it, we did not allow them to shut down. Reasons, mostly because of lack of access for too many of our kids to a device. You had to have an explicit paper plan for remote learning. Another reason was access to a hot meal, where for schools it might have been their only opportunity of the day for too many kids in our state to get a reliable meal. So we took an extra couple of days to make sure we got that right. And I want to make sure we get any major shift in our population in our corrections community also as right as we can.
How have you responded to police and corrections officers unions that have opposed releases and other reforms? Have they come to you with their concerns and tried to block anything?
I have not gotten incomings personally. It's not to say that my team has not. They also are worried about their own populations. You know, you look at the corrections officers, we've lost some. Healthcare workers who work in corrections facilities, we've lost some. You know, they're focused not just on what we're doing with the prison population, they're focused on their own ranks, as they should be, and understandably.
Governor, give me the political dynamics of dealing with the prison population in particular. There are people on one end of the political spectrum saying you can't let anybody out. And then there have been voices, particularly on the left, who say, well, in this situation, this incredibly horrific emergency situation, all prisoners should be let out because of the circumstances of prisons themselves, which are where everybody's up against each other and things can spread like wildfire.
Yep. So I'd say a couple of things. Number one, there's no scenario where we can let all prisoners out. I mean, I've got to draw the line between violent and nonviolent. And that's a line that we'll adhere to. For the folks, even in the violent offender category, I hope sooner than later we'll be able to achieve the social distancing and the sort of basics that may be more difficult or may have been more difficult without any of these releases. And secondly, I haven't really spent any time on the politics. In all the steps we've taken, we're trying to make the call as best we can based on the facts, based on the data, based on the science.
But are you have to say to yourself in the position that you're in uniquely, I'm willing to put certain people at much higher risk, that is leave them in prison because of their past record. Is that what you're saying? That violent offenders, they're going to just be at higher risk because I can't let them out.
I think you can say both of those things, that, you know what, I'm sorry, but the violent offenders are going to have to stay in the system, but we're going to be able to much more appropriately and proactively care for their well-being while they're in the system.
Governor Murphy, I wish you the best, and thank you so much.
Thanks for being on, David.
So, Kai, for those who are being released, what happens to them after they get out of prison? They're re-entering society at an incredibly stressful, complicated moment.
Yeah, it's hard to say, quite honestly. I mean, for a number of people, they're being released into home detention, right? So they're being sent either with ankle bracelets or back into their homes to quarantine with their families. It raises an enormous number of questions. I mean, one of the things that we have to remember is that part of what's happened in mass incarceration is we have turned prisons into the one place where people get a number of social services that they need, from alcohol and drug treatment to mental health treatment, in many cases to forms of health care. And so there are a number of things that have to be done in folks' lives because of the way we've organized society. And I think it's going to be jurisdiction by jurisdiction a challenge to figure out how to do this. I think the hopeful note is that if they do that, if we're able to figure out how to do reentry correctly in the course of this in those places, it may make that a much easier process when this is over as well.
Well, I was going to ask, do you think that this terrible experience, which is affecting so much of society in so many ways, might have some kind of influence on the criminal justice system when we are past COVID-19?
I think it depends on what you mean. So I think in the sense of that there will be counties and states in particular who will have made the political and economic investment in decarceration of some sort. And I think that you will see a permanent downtick in some of those places in terms of the number of people who are held in these facilities. But on a broader level, in terms of changing our faith, which is really the only way you can describe it, our faith in the idea that punishment and incarceration is the way to deal with social ills, I don't see how this changes that in any way. I mean, that's rooted in 150 years worth of racist ideas about the ways in which Black and brown people are a threat to society. And this crisis won't upend that. The only thing that would upend that is a change in political power. And indeed, I'm probably most concerned about the ways in which this crisis will decrease the political power of the communities that are most affected by mass incarceration.
Why do you say that?
Well, because we are in the middle of an election year, and the people who are most affected by this are the people who are most easily disenfranchised. And I think one of the problems that we are going to be staring down as this crisis unfolds is how does democracy continue to function?
Kai, thanks so much.
Thank you. You can hear the entire episode of the New Yorker Radio Hour in that show's feed right now. And while you're there, also scroll down to a previous episode in which David and I explored the past and future of the prison abolition movement. And we're going to continue our partnership with David and the New Yorker Radio Hour in the coming weeks. Some people are getting out, not just in New Jersey, but around the country. But that's just the beginning of their journey. What happens once they go home? We'll let you know in an upcoming episode. The United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios. This episode was produced by our partners over at the New Yorker Radio Hour with help from Vera Lynn Williams. It was mixed by Isaac Jones. Our executive producer is Karen Frillman. Our team also includes Emily Botine, Jenny Casas, Marianne McCune, and Christopher Wirth, with help this week from Kim Nowaki. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. And do keep in touch. You can follow me on Twitter at Kai_Wright. Thanks for listening, and take care of yourselves.